Representative Sarah Flanders out of New York. And as always, we appreciate you being with us on another debate. I'm Marzia Hashemi, signing off for myself and all the crew right here in Tehran.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily via the internet address www.parstoday.com/en. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Intelsat 902, and Eutelsat satellite, as well as via internet. You can also listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for more details.
We draw your attention to verses 54 and 55 of Chapter Araf from the Holy Quran, recited by Mr. Ali Asghar Burumand.
A'udhu billahi minash shaitanir rajim. Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Inna رَبَّكُمُ اللَّهُ الَّذِي خَلَقَ السَّمَاوَاتِ وَالْأَرْضَ فِي سِتَّةِ أَيَّامٍ خَلَقَ السَّمَاوَاتِ وَالْأَرْضَ فِي سِتَّةِ أَيَّامٍ ثُمَّ اسْتَوَى عَلَى الْعَرْشِ الليل النهار يقلبه حثيثا والشمس والقمر والنجوم مسخرات ألا له الخلق والأمر تبارك الله رب العالمين ادعوا ربكم تضرعا وخفية صدق الله العلي العظيم.
In the name of God, the most compassionate, the most merciful. Surely, your Lord is Allah, who created the heavens and the earth in six periods of time, and He is firm in power. He throws the veil of night over the day, which it pursues incessantly. And He created the sun and the moon and the stars, made subservient by His command. Surely, His is the creation and the command. Blessed is Allah, the Lord of the worlds. Call on your Lord humbly and secretly. Surely, He does not love those who exceed the limits.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news. Top stories. Iran dismisses the United States allegations that it has been involved in recent attacks on bases housing American troops in Iraq. London police chief dismisses calls to step down amid anger over heavy-handed response to a vigil held in tribute to a woman killed by an officer. Also in the headlines, political crisis grips German Chancellor Angela Merkel's Conservative Party following its heavy defeats in two key state elections. Those were the top stories. Welcome. Tehran has dismissed the Washington allegation that Iran has been involved in recent attacks on U.S. military installations in Iraq. Iran's ambassador to the United Nations, Majid Takht-Ravanchi, made the comment in a letter addressed to U.N. Secretary General Antonio Guterres. Takht-Ravanchi stressed that the Islamic Republic has not been directly or indirectly involved in any armed attack against any U.S. individual or body in Iraq. He, however, denounced U.S. airstrikes against the position of Iraqi forces on the Iraqi-Syrian border in February, calling them a gross violation of international law and a breach of the U.N. Charter. The Iranian diplomat warned that such attacks only exacerbate the already tense situation of the region and, in effect, only serve the interests of terrorist groups. Author and political commentator Kevin Barrett says the United States is trying to find a scapegoat for its illegal activities in the region.
This war criminal nation that's still committing war crimes every second that it continues to occupy Iraq is accusing Iran, Iraq's neighbor, which has actually played a very moderate and constructive role in the region of resisting the U.S. occupation of Iraq is absurd. It is, of course, the people of Iraq who are resisting the U.S. occupation of Iraq. And they need a scapegoat. They need an excuse to blame Iran so they can continue with this false flag 9/11 agenda of going after seven countries in 5 years. They didn't get it done in 5 years, but some of these neocons haven't given up yet.
The United States has, for the first time, acknowledged that the Yemen war has no military solution. U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken told U.N. Special Envoy for Yemen Martin Griffiths that diplomatic efforts should be redoubled alongside the United Nations and others to end the war in Yemen. Blinken's comments come as the Yemeni Ansarullah movement has stepped up its retaliatory attacks on Saudi Arabia. Riyadh launched its aggression against Yemen back in 2015. Tens of thousands of Yemenis have been killed in Saudi attacks ever since. Washington has been the main supplier of arms to Riyadh and has supported the Saudi-led coalition in Yemen. Political commentator Ken Stone says time and again the U.S. has proven itself not to be a reliable partner.
The main point is, concerning this most recent announcement, that anything that the U.S. says has to be taken with a big grain of salt. About a month ago, both President Biden and Secretary of State Blinken made statements to the effect that the U.S. would halt arms sales to the Saudi coalition and would not tolerate Saudi offensive attacks on Yemen. However, in the interim, in the past month, the one U.S. arms manufacturer announced a huge sale to Saudi Arabia, and in addition, Saudi coalition planes, have bombed Yemen on several occasions, killing many civilians. Time and again, the U.S. has proven itself not to be a reliable partner.
Yemen's bloc of anti-aggression parties has held a political event in the capital, Sana'a, to discuss the danger of extremist organizations. Participants said things are worsened by the presence of Saudi and Emirati forces which support the terrorists in the south of Yemen. Abdul Latif al-Washali.
Yemen's bloc of anti-aggression parties has held a symposium in the capital Sana'a to discuss the repercussions of the Takfiri organization's presence in the country. It comes as the army pushes its offensive to liberate the province of Marib from terrorist groups.
This event is to inform the Yemenis of the danger of the foreign presence and terrorist organizations, especially in the southern governorates, and it coincides with the continuing battle of Marib, which has led to mass flight of terrorists from areas previously controlled by Saudi Arabia and the UAE.
The participants in the symposium said foreign forces, including those of Saudi Arabia and the UAE, are the main supporters of the terrorists in different parts of the country. The participants called for purging Marib from Takfiri terrorists.
Everyone knows that the terrorism in the Arab world is rooted in the Wahhabi ideology and is waged with the support of Saudi Arabia. The country is still the center of terrorism, and other countries have joined it, trying to spread these ideas among Muslims. The U.S. and Britain are sponsoring these terrorists and exploiting them against axes of resistance to spread chaos in countries which oppose U.S. policies in the region.
Saudi Arabia has led a U.S.-backed aggression on Yemen since the beginning of 2015 that has killed tens of thousands of Yemenis and has also unleashed terrorists backed by Riyadh and its allies on the war-torn country. Yemenis believe that Riyadh wants to keep a hand on oil-rich provinces of their country, especially Marib. They say Saudis are advancing their agenda by backing terrorist groups with money and weapons. Abdul Latif al-Washali, Sana'a.
Palestinian Authority has ordered a five-day lockdown in the occupied West Bank amid a surge in coronavirus cases. Mona Candil is in Ramallah.
Hospitals across the occupied West Bank are full and intensive care units operating at over 100% capacity as the number of the coronavirus patients in some cities is growing significantly. A new field hospital is set to open near occupied city of Ramallah, and some parks will be converted to field hospitals as well in an attempt to cope with the new wave of infections.
The number of patients exceeds the capacity of hospitals, in particular, the capacity of the oxygen generators as well as the beds. We've opened new wards as the situation has deteriorated, but the wards open and the numbers continue to rise, we're at 100% capacity in general, even at 110% capacity in some hospitals. That's why there's an urgent need for field hospitals, and we have information that the work will start in 2 days.
Palestinian Health Minister May Al-Kayla said earlier that the West Bank is facing a third wave of the pandemic. The Palestinian government has imposed new restrictions, including the closure of schools and universities, but it seems that measures have failed to quell rising infections among the Palestinians.
This situation is very difficult. It can be described as an unprecedented coronavirus cases spike. We were hoping not to open field hospitals, but to witness an end to this virus. After recommendations from Health Directorate and the Ministry of Health, there is an urgent need for a serious position from all the Palestinians. After 1 year, they should completely abide by the measures.
People of the West Bank demand the Palestinian Authority to import vaccines. However, the PA has managed to acquire only a few thousand doses of vaccines, not even enough for frontline health workers. As observers say, the gap between Israel and the Palestinians has illustrated the global inequity between rich and poor nations in terms of access to vaccines. UN officials and the human rights groups have expressed concerns over the disparity, saying Israel is an occupying power that is responsible for the well-being of the Palestinians.
1 year on, the COVID-19 still rages on in the occupied West Bank, with hospitals filled up amid shortage of medical equipment. This has led the Palestinian Authority to adopt new measures, including strict lockdown, to cope with the new wave of the pandemic. Mona Kandik, occupied Ramallah.
The British Prime Minister pledges to take actions aimed at protecting women and amid nationwide outrage over kidnapping and killing of a woman by a police officer. Boris Johnson has promised reviews into police's heavy-handed tactics against female demonstrators holding a vigil to call attention to violence against women. Johnson will hold a meeting with the Justice Task Force to discuss the issue. He says London police and a watchdog will conduct separate reviews into the handling of the protest. Anger flared up after Sarah Everard was found dead days after she went missing on March the 3rd. A police officer was later charged with kidnapping and murdering her. The London police chief has rejected calls to resign over violence during the vigil. More than 100 women have reportedly been killed in mysterious circumstances over the past year in the UK. Our correspondent in London, Ahmed Caballo, says UK police have failed, both in terms of their response to the Sarah Everard vigil and their responsibility to protect young women like her. Take a listen.
Now, around the same time as this tragic case, there was a YouGov poll that said 97% of women, young women, have been harassed in public spaces, 80% of all women. Now, yesterday, there was a vigil in South London, in Clapham. I attended this vigil. It was expected to be a quiet vigil, yet the police used very heavy-handed nature to disperse the vigil, arrested several women, and this has only added to the anger on the ground. Now, the vigil was called off by the British Home Office, and people were advised to stay away. But nonetheless, the way the police reacted was completely disproportionate, particularly considering the sensitivity of this case, as the accused is a sitting Metropolitan Police officer, and many people were shouting at the police officers that were arresting women, arrest your own, i.e. sort out your own institution, which has been accused of two very grievous crimes here. Not only did a sitting Metropolitan Police officer allegedly kidnap and murder a woman while walking home, but apparently, a couple of days before that, he exposed himself in an indecent way in a McDonald's restaurant. And had he been arrested and charged for that, then Sarah Everard would still be alive today. That's why people are angry.
Now, German Chancellor Angela Merkel's Conservative Party has suffered heavy losses in two key regional elections. media. Estimates show Merkel's Christian Democratic Union Party has scored its worst ever results in two southwestern states that were considered conservative strongholds. In Baden-Württemberg, a sturgeon Green Party has taken the lead. In neighboring Rhineland-Palatinate state, the left-leaning Social Democrats are projected to retain power. CDU members say the coronavirus pandemic has triggered their poor results.
The CDU and other parties could not get their programs presented, and that made the campaigning very difficult. It was campaigning in extraordinary times with an extraordinary result. And we will analyze all the external and internal influences, such as coronavirus and the Massey scandal. But those are internal issues, and internally, I can also state very clearly that the CDU remains strong despite the developments of the past weeks.
Officials from CDU's Bavarian sister party, CSU, described the results as a wake-up call, saying Germany's largest bloc needs to win back public trust. The Sunday regional elections are seen as an indication of what might happen in Germany's September general elections when Merkel's successor will be chosen. Her government has faced criticism in recent months, partly because of a sluggish COVID-19 vaccination program and a mask procurement scandal. Australian women hold nationwide rallies to call for gender equality and justice for victims of sexual assault. Thousands of women gathered in front of the Parliament building in the capital city of Canberra. Women also hit the streets in more than 40 cities and towns. The protests were sparked by a recent wave of allegations of sexual assault and discrimination in some of Australia's highest political offices, including the Parliament. The government has ordered an independent inquiry into Parliament's workplace culture, but critics say systemic change is needed. Iran's Islamic Revolution Guards Corps has launched the largest mobile hospital in West Asia. The hospital was unveiled during a ceremony in the capital, Tehran. Humayun Abedi has filed a report.
A mobile hospital with 128 beds was inaugurated by the ground force of Iran's Islamic Revolution Guards Corps to give service to people amid the coronavirus pandemic in the areas that have no access to medical care. This hospital is a combination of containers and tents along with bus hospital systems that can be set up in remote areas. The commander of the IRGC ground force and the health minister attended the opening ceremony.
The IRGC's ground forces have been at the front for the building mobile hospitals. We have used these systems since 2010 in the deprived areas, especially Sistan and Balochistan province, and the southeast and northwest of the country. Today, we are launching one of the largest mobile hospitals after almost 11 years of experience in setting up mobile hospitals in different parts of the country.
The most up-to-date specialized and technical medical equipment are installed in this hospital, and it has different wards, MRI, and mobile CT scan systems as well.
Since the outbreak of the coronavirus, we were thinking about the launch of a mobile hospital equipped with all the facilities needed to treat COVID-19 patients. This is the only mobile hospital equipped with PCR test facilities and CT scan systems. In addition, all the personnel and crew are particularly trained for their tasks at this hospital.
According to officials, this hospital is unique in the region, and such a facility has never been built and launched in the country. One of the special features of the new system of the IRGC Mobile Biosafety Hospital is the ability to move quickly in providing specific services in times of crisis. All the national and international standards have also been observed to provide healthcare services. The IRGC commanders told us that this mobile hospital can give services to the people in the remote areas of the country for 1 month without having access to the urban facilities. Humayun Abedi, Tehran.
Protests have been held in the state of São Paulo in Brazil after the state government mandated further restrictions to curb the spread of COVID-19. The announcement of further curbs came after the country witnessed a dramatic rise in the number of coronavirus infections and fatalities. The country has registered over 1,100 new deaths, bringing the total fatalities to nearly 280,000. Around 44,000 new cases were also recorded, taking the overall infections to almost 11.5 million. Brazil is second only to the United States in terms of both fatalities and infections. The U.S. has recorded nearly 535,000 deaths and almost 30 million cases. Mr. Lio Shajdi, a professor of international relations in Inter-American University of Puerto Rico, says COVID-19 restrictions imposed in countries, including in Brazil, lead to a slowdown in businesses.
One thing is, for instance, the lockdowns, the policies to try to stop the expansion of the virus, and that means less business. And of course, let us not forget that Sao Paulo is the most populated state in Brazil. I believe in 2019, close to, 46 million people. Also, it used to have, well, I'm sure still does, the largest gross domestic product of all states in Brazil, over 2 billion reales, I believe, back in 2016-17. So, of course, the economic results that have been disastrous, a disaster for the world, for the developing countries, for everybody, because of the lockdowns and all the measures to try to prevent the spread of the disease, that I'm sure has gotten to the limit for many business owners. So it doesn't have to be somebody with a business. It could be an independent worker, those called autonomous workers, that also are suffering the impact of the pandemic.
That's your world news for now.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
The all-compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah, who allowed none to witness when He created the heavens and the earth, and who took no helper when He authored the spirits. He has no associate in divinity and no support in unity. Tongues fall silent before the limits of describing Him. Intellects fail before the core of knowing Him. Terrors fall low in awe of Him. Faces are humbled in fear of Him. And everything mighty yields to His mightiness. So to Thee belongs praise again and again, well measured, continually, and methodically. And may His blessings be upon His messenger endlessly, and His salutation everlastingly, eternally. O Allah, make the beginning of this day of mine righteousness, its middle prosperity, and its end success. I seek refuge in Thee from a day whose beginning is fright, and whose middle is anxiety, and whose end is pain. O Allah, I pray forgiveness from Thee for every vow I have vowed, and every promise I have promised, and every pledge I have pledged, then failed to keep for thee. I ask thee concerning the complaints of thy servants against me. If there is a servant from among thy servants, of a handmaid from among thy handmaids, who has against me a complaint, because I have wronged him in respect to himself, his reputation, his property, his wife or his child, or because evil words I have spoken about him in his absence, an imposition upon him through inclination, caprice, scorn, zeal, false show, bigotry, whether he be absent or present, alive or dead, such that my hand has fallen short and my capacity has been too narrow to make restitution to him or to annul my obligation to him, I ask thee, O he who owns all objects of need which are granted by his will and hastened to his desire, that thou blessest Muhammad and the household of Muhammad, peace be upon them, and makest the one I have wronged satisfied with me in the manner that thou willst, and givest me mercy from thee. Forgiveness decreases thee not, and giving injuries thee not. O most merciful of the merciful, O Allah, give me on every Monday two favors from thee: the facility to obey thee at its beginning, and the favor of thy forgiveness at its end. O he who is Allah, and none other than whom grants forgiveness for sins.
Limelight. States with democratic governors had the highest incidence and death rates from COVID-19 in the first month of the coronavirus pandemic, but the states with Republican governors surpassed those rates as the crisis dragged on, a study released recently found. From March to early June, Republican-led states had lower COVID-19 incidence compared with Democratic-led states. On June 3rd, the association reversed and Republican-led states had higher incidence. The study by researchers at Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health and the Medical University of South Carolina showed. Dear listeners, stay with us for an article in this regard written by Chris Walker, author. This article is published under the heading, GOP-run states saw higher COVID death rates, study shows. Here's more on that. A new study which examines the outcomes of different states' approaches to the coronavirus pandemic based on what party their governors belong to shows that for most of 2020, states with Republican governors were more likely to see higher incidence rates and death tolls versus states with Democratic governors. Published in the peer-reviewed American Journal of Preventive Medicine this month, the study conducted by researchers at Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health and the Medical University of South Carolina took a look at different parts of the pandemic and saw a noticeable shift happening at the start of summer last year. At the onset of the pandemic, from March until early June, there were higher per capita incidence rates as well as deaths from the virus within Democratic states. But from July through the remainder of the year, states with Republican governors had worse outcomes.
From March to early June, Republican-led states had lower COVID-19 incidence rates compared with Democratic-led states. On June 3rd, the association reversed, and Republican-led states had higher incidence, the study said. For death rates, Republican-led states had lower rates early in the pandemic, but higher rates from July 4th through mid-December, the study added. Governors' party affiliation may have contributed to a range of policy decisions that, together, influenced the spread of the virus, said the study's senior author Sarah Benjamin Nealon, a professor in the Bloomberg School Department of Health, Behavior and Society. These findings underscore the need for state policy actions that are guided by public health considerations rather than by partisan politics, unquote. Why did blue states fare worse at the start of the pandemic than red ones? The researchers theorize it had less to do with policies implemented by Democratic governors, and more because those areas were home to initial ports of entry for the virus in early 2020. Meanwhile, researchers said the subsequent reversal in trends, particularly with respect to testing, may reflect policy differences that could have facilitated the spread of the virus, the study stated. The pandemic, the authors added, became increasingly politicized in the U.S., and political affiliation of state leaders may contribute to policies affecting the spread of the disease. Several Republican governors did indeed prioritize reopening their states' economies, with detrimental outcomes around the time the study said things began to shift. Former President Donald Trump himself seemed to politicize methods to stem the spread of coronavirus, stating in a Wall Street Journal interview that he thought people wore masks in order to demonstrate their disapproval of him. Trump also tried to wrongly suggest in September that drastic rises in the number of cases and deaths due to COVID-19 were not because some states were loosening standards, but rather due to Democratic leadership. Blue states had tremendous death rates. If you take the blue states out, we are at a level that I don't think anybody in the world would be at, Trump had claimed. We are really at a very low level, but some of the states, they were blue states and blue state managed, he added. The findings of the Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health and the Medical University of South Carolina study demonstrate that the former president's assertions were way off.
This is IRIB English Radio. Our website is www.parstoday.com www.irib.org/en.
Economic divide.
Hello and welcome to Economic Divide with me, Kavit Hathaway. In this week's show, we will be looking at the economy of Myanmar and ascertain just how this nation, gripped by a political crisis, namely because of the coup, can economically survive with massive protests taking place. When it comes to Myanmar's economy, it is one of the least developed of the East Asia region and is basically agricultural. That means much of the population is engaged directly in that field. Nearly half of Myanmar's economy, meaning all large industrial enterprises like the banking system or foreign trade, was nationalized in 1962-63. It talks about how Myanmar's economy was affected by the coronavirus crisis along with the coup. The dip occurs, that's the Q2 of the year 2020. GDP growth rates falling, even though it had the highest in Asia. When you take a look at the GDP for Myanmar, it doesn't have a chance of recuperating because the coup and the eventual crisis has now gripped the nation. It talks about gas prices that Myanmar counted on revenues from that. The revenues comprised 40% of exports and 20% of government revenues for the fiscal year 2018-19. Well, let's now take a look into our first report. It studies how Myanmar had formed a promising economy after a civilian government took power a little over a decade ago, and how the recent political crisis has affected the economy as a whole.
Located in Southeast Asia, Myanmar is a country of over 50 million people. The country was ruled by an oppressive military government from 1962 to 2011. It's a nation in transition, haunted by a past marred by authoritarian rule and economic mismanagement.
Although there was the process of democratization in Myanmar, it was a framework by which the civilian government, but the military, still had influence in the country. And it needed the influence to protect their huge business and economic interests in Myanmar.
However, the beginning of a democratic transition a decade ago made Myanmar's untapped potential available to foreign investors. Investors pumped money into telecommunications, infrastructure, manufacturing, and construction projects.
Joining me in the studio is current affairs and impact analyst Mahan Abedin. We also have with us Khin Za Win, director of the Tampa Dipa Institute. They worked on policy advocacy on communal issues, land, and nationalism. And he was also a prisoner of conscience in Myanmar for seditious writings and human rights work from 1994 through 2005. I'd like to welcome you both. First to you, Khin Za Win, Myanmar's economy dominated by the military junta, even though the country emerged from military rule in 2011. But how much of the economy did the junta control, and how does the ending of the military rule, when it did, impact the economy?
Well, military rule ended, let's say, partly for only 10 years. Now they are back in force. But whatever they did, their economy was not affected. The part of the economy that's controlled by the military is not affected at all. That's the thing that people don't realize. There's the economy that you can see and there's the economy that you can't see. Now, all that the civilian governments and no power in Myanmar can ever touch. And people think that it has even expanded during the last 10 years.
Well, what does the army control and actually spend its money on?
All right. It has its own bank. It has its own broadcasting station, logistics, you know, a lot of things. Of course, when they want to buy armaments, they dip into the national budget, you know. But those things, I think it's quite like in China. The People's Liberation Army controls a lot of conglomerates, you know, and that is what is happening. It's exactly what is happening. You see that in Thailand and Indonesia. But in Myanmar, it's even worse, because they want political power, and they want to expand their economic power as well. This is not limited to the military, unfortunately. There is a budget heading, accounts heading, called other accounts, you know, in local parlance. And that means that you can't investigate or find out where those accounts go to. So in Myanmar, a lot of money and a lot of the national budget and income is unaccounted for. It's terrible, you know. We are a least developed country, people are poor, but the military, as well as many civilian ministries, are having their own, let's say, lucrative deals and accounting systems, you know. And it's terrible. It's terrible. It's like all the accounting is done undercover.
Okay, Mahan, Myanmar's transformation from military rule to a civilian one took place in 2011. How do you view that? I mean, did the military junta leaders actually give up much of their control over Myanmar when that happened? Or was that just a kind of a facade, which in their eyes, giving up some of the sectors in the economy, for example, would portray that type of image?
Well, I think it was a genuine political transition of sorts, a shift, if you like. But economically, it wasn't, because since the late 80s, the Myanmar military has used primarily two vehicles to drive through its command of the economy. One is the Myanmar Economic Corporation, the other is Myanmar Economic Holding. And through these vehicles, they've essentially controlled privatization, taking up, you know, formerly state-owned enterprises at fire sale prices and giving it to their cronies and associates. And the political transition in 2011 hasn't affected that. So what you find today is that the Myanmar military still controls the commanding heights of the economy. It has most of the concessions, it has, you know, the best lands, it gets the licenses for, you know, the juicy part of the economy, if you like, the expensive stones, the gems, and the rest, timber, mining, consumables. They control the commanding heights. So really, that transition from an economic point of view wasn't altogether very significant.
Okay, very well. Thank you very much for that. Right now, we're going to take a look at our next item up here, which is going to be our second report. It focuses on the garment sector, while the U.S. President Joe Biden reintroduced sanctions to the Myanmarese generals due to the coup that took place, threatening this young democracy.
Following the coup by Myanmar's junta, the U.S. President Joe Biden reimposed sanctions on military juntas, which were formally removed back in 2016.
We will identify at first round of targets this week, and we're also going to impose strong exports controls. We're freezing U.S. assets that benefit the Burmese government while maintaining our support for health care, civil society groups, and other areas that benefit the people of Burma directly.
Now, the military, the generals have often said that they are impervious to international pressure. It just doesn't matter what the international community does. It's going to do whatever it wants to do. And, of course, they're used to not being held accountable by anybody. So this is, you know, rough seas for them, as if I can use the word.
Moreover, the European Union is considering an economic embargo. If both come into effect, it can put the country's rag trade industry and its 700,000 workers at serious risk. The garment sector has boomed in recent years and has attracted many household brands such as H&M, Gap, and Adidas.
International backlashes against the coup could discourage foreign investors from providing financial resources for Myanmar's companies.
The seizure of power by the Myanmar military earlier this month constitutes a profound setback for the country after a decade of hard-won gains in its democratic transition.
As the more Myanmar democratized, the more engagement the West wanted with Myanmar in economic terms. Because Myanmar has huge economic potential. It is a fast-growing economy. So certainly there is interest from the West to invest and to trade with Myanmar. But it usually came with the process of democratization that we'd like to see taking place in Myanmar.
Back with me in the studio is Mahan Abedin and Khin Zawin. Welcome to you both again. Okay, Khin Zawin, U.S. incentives or intentions in Myanmar. Incentives were given to the Myanmarese government and the democratic process hence began. What intentions do you think the U.S. has in Myanmar?
Well, to that question, I would say it would be patently impossible to do that, you know, to pull Myanmar out of orbit and into the orbit of the United States. What it can do, you know, what's possible and what it really intends to do is have Myanmar reduce its dependence on the Chinese economy, you know, and make it diversify. American companies have come in, you know, Coca-Cola, Chevrolet, and all that, but they are under a lot of congressional scrutiny, human rights and all that, you know, and so they are kind of hampered. The previous American ambassador was trying very hard to go to Mandalay, that's in northern Myanmar, very close to China, and try to have American companies set up there or invest there. That is all that the West can do.
Okay, Mahan, you heard our guest there. What do you think the U.S. intentions are in Myanmar? Obviously, economically speaking, that opens the door, and then U.S. can then grab a foothold. Now with the coup happened, I think those things are now in serious doubt. Many companies are pulling out. U.S. intentions in Myanmar, the focus of my question to you here.
Yeah, I think it's more complex than that. I don't think there's going to be a great severance here between Myanmar, the U.S., or the West in general, because the West likes to keep a foothold in Myanmar. They have done so for many years, even during the so-called pre-democracy days, pre-2011, when Aung San Suu Kyi was under house arrest for all those decades. So they've made a lot of noise in the immediate aftermath of the military, you know, taking over politics again. But I don't think that translates to a severance. And I think the Myanmar leadership, be it the former civilian leadership and now the military leadership, and who knows what will take place in the next few years, there may be a fusion between the military and the civilian. They realize that in view of their geopolitical profile and their location and their status as a state, they have to keep the big powers balanced. They have to keep a balance between China and the rest. So yeah, China has huge influence in Myanmar, but I think the Myanmar leadership is smart enough to balance that, mm-hmm. you know, potentially with Western influence.
Okay, thank you very much for that. All right, we're now about to take a short break here on Economic Divide, but don't go anywhere as we have plenty more coming up. Stay right where you are. Welcome back to Economic Divide with Nika Batathley. Time now to take a look at some of the other economic headlines hitting the front pages in our info news section. First up, we go to Haiti. The political crisis there is heating up. Thousands of Haitians have taken to the streets of Port-au-Prince this past week to demand an end to President Jovenel Moïse's term in office. Now, many Haitians, like the Black Alliance for Peace, believe that there should be an end to the U.S.-backed dictatorship of the current president. The economy in Haiti, as a result of the policies of this president, has declined over 3.1% for the year 2020. Next up, we go to Ecuador. The elections there are reported to have been undermined by foreign and domestic interference, according to an ex-diplomat. Ecuador plunged into political uncertainty because the Ecuadorians do not yet know who will run in a runoff presidential election. Meanwhile, the economy is weakening as it has slid into recession due to the previous administration's mismanagement. And staying with the Americas, Brazil's economy, the largest in Latin America, contracted 4.1% in 2020. That is the biggest drop in more than 30 years. That's mainly due to the COVID-19 pandemic. The fall in GDP exceeded the 3.5% decline seen in the year 2015. And in absolute terms, it was the biggest decline since 1990, when the economy retracted 4.35%. Well, it's time now to take a look at our final report of the show, which looks at how, even after the coup, it's business as usual for some of Myanmar's trading partners, like China, Hong Kong, and India.
The coup in Myanmar will push the country even further into China's arms as the country's biggest trading partner. Also, Beijing's One Belt, One Road initiative includes rail and deep sea port projects that feature Myanmar prominently. That will provide monetary benefits for the country. However, Myanmar's third largest trading partner, Japan, has acted differently. After the coup, Japanese car giant Suzuki suspended operations at its two Myanmar factories, which produced over 13,000 vehicles in 2019. That is while Suzuki has had operations in Myanmar since the year 1998, when the country was under the junta rule and was constructing a third production plant. Apparently, the only one celebrating the tumultuous financial situation is the military, with huge business interests including jade mining, construction, pharmaceuticals, manufacturing, insurance, tourism, and banking.
The military in Myanmar holds a significant amount of control over the economy. They have huge business interests. In fact, you could legitimately say that they hold a business empire in Myanmar. So the Myanmar generals certainly have, I mean, the military, the generals, they have a lot of interest, economic and business interest in Myanmar.
As we have seen in the past, they cannot build the kind of prosperity and economy and opportunity for their country as an isolated backwater, and that's the direction that they're heading in. That is against the interest of everyone, including themselves.
I'm pleased to welcome back one more time current affairs and impact analyst Mon Abedin and Khinza Nguyen, the director of the Tampa Deepa Institute in Yangon. Gentlemen, welcome back. Okay, final question to you. The coup already affecting the economy, many Western firms scrambling what to do. The UN has said foreign firms should suspend all of their businesses in Myanmar. The coup is going to obviously hurt the people and the economy. The Americans imposing sanctions. Won't U.S. sanctions actually push Myanmar pretty much into the arms of China?
I'll answer that last bit first. That was what happened in the 1990s. You know, when the first wave of sanctions came in, Myanmar just had to, look at China, you know, find reliance, dependency on China, because there was no other way. Now, the West doesn't want that to happen again. And it is quite inescapable. For instance, our economy is dominated still by agriculture, you know, and the agricultural commodities are perishable, and the nearest and the biggest market is China. So it's still there. But on manufacturing, services, other things, well, other countries, you know, and other markets can come in.
Okay, I'd like to thank Khinza Nguyen, the director of the Tampa Deepa Institute in Yangon. It was great to have him on the show. So, Mahan, the military junta, based on the coup that has happened, appear to want the power back. Maybe they felt like their political power was waning. Maybe they felt that major industries were now escaping them, or they're losing grip on that. How much influence do you think, in this case, China is going to have on Myanmar to pull it to its sphere? Because we know that the U.S. is on this offensive when it comes to Southeast Asian nations and pulling it out of China's orbit.
Well, on the first part of your question, I do think the economic dimension was important. As I stated earlier, in the early days after 2011, there wasn't such a huge shift economically. You know, the military was able to maintain its monopolies, and I think they still did towards the end, but there were some sections of the government that wanted to push back against the military. I think that may have played a big role in the decision for the military to come to the fore of politics again, which I think is going to be temporary. I don't think you're going to see a situation like in the 80s and 90s and the early noughties where the military stays at the forefront for decades. This is going to be relatively short-lived. On the question of China, look, China is a big player in Myanmar, but Myanmar is also fiercely independent. You know, it doesn't want to become a satellite state for anybody. So, you know, they will keep a balanced approach. And, you know, it's also noteworthy that the Western powers, the US and the UK in particular, so far they've only imposed token sanctions on the Myanmar system. I mean, they haven't really gone out to punish these people, even during the so-called Rohingya genocide. I mean, I hesitate to mention genocide because I don't know the full fact, but certainly the Rohingya minority were being terribly repressed at a minimum. The West did nothing apart from some, you know, rhetorical condemnations.
Sure.
It's also noteworthy that the previous civilian government led by Aung San Suu Kyi, they also, you know, they were in complete alliance with the military in terms of suppressing that minority. So politics there is more complex than you're led to believe. But I think above all, Myanmar is this very proud, fiercely independent country, you know, and I think the military really has a grip there economically.
Okay.
And they're not going to loosen up anytime soon.
Thank you very much. Mohan Abedin, Current Affairs and Impact Analyst, thank you. As usual,
you're
great
welcome.
To hear your thoughts.
Thank you.
In this in-depth section, we picked up on something that our guest, Mustafa Izzuddin, said. When it comes to how this coup would affect Myanmar vis-a-vis the U.S., the West, then China, an interesting point that came up by him which may indicate why Myanmar may be of interest to the U.S. Our question to him was...
No, I don't see that happening. I don't see Myanmar as being a flashpoint between US and China. So China looks at Myanmar more through the lens of its own national interests and particularly economic interests, and to some extent also strategic interests. Myanmar shares the border with China, and Myanmar is an important country for China because it is also a member of ASEAN.
So that could be of major interest to the US. Let's take a look at this border area. There, on the northeastern section. That is the border area between Myanmar and China. Given how the U.S. is provoking China and has cited it as the greatest political risk, it would not be surprising that there would be great U.S. military interest in Myanmar. A history check on Myanmar reveals what may not be known to many. Burma, as it was known, was under military rule from the year 1962 to the year 2011. Now, that's over 40 years. Can you just imagine then how most of the businesses were nationalized and under the government control, or under the control of the military junta leaders? Well, it wasn't until the year 1988 when the government permitted modest expansion of the private sector, allowing some foreign investment and receiving much-needed foreign exchange as a result. This sparked the democratic elections in the year 2011, which opened Myanmar's doors to the world, becoming one of the fastest-growing economies in that region. Now, why the army would want to claim fraud in the November elections, that's anybody's guess. Did they feel that they needed to get back control of some of the businesses that had begun to flourish over the past years? Or did they anticipate the backlash, which so far has resulted in over 50 deaths? Well, as it stands, foreign investment and companies need to make a hard decision as to whether they will stay in this country or just pack up and count the losses. Certainly China is not going to mind Myanmar getting close to it, while pushing back against the U.S. was imposed sanctions on its leaders. That's about all the time we have in this episode. On behalf of myself, Clever Tavley, and the whole team here on Economic Divide, stay safe.
Limelight. Disparities along income and racial lines have persisted in vaccination campaigns. For example, in the United States, Black Americans have received the vaccine at half the rate of white Americans, and the disparity is even larger for Hispanic Americans. We now present you an article written by Yara M. Assi under the heading Vaccine Passports, a Cause for Hope and Concern. The article has been taken from the Conversation website. Please stay with us for more of Yara M. Assi's article.